I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, public libraries in America today face a complex landscape of growth, innovation, and escalating challenges. While they continue to serve as vital community hubs, offering digital access, literacy programs, and workforce development, they are increasingly under political and financial pressure. In 2024, the American Library Association documented 821 attempts to censor books and materials across U.S. libraries. Financially, libraries are grappling with significant strains. The Trump defunding of the Institute of Museum and Library Services has jeopardized essential services, particularly in rural and underserved communities. Tonight on PBS, the Independent Lens documentary airs Free for All, the Public Library, and we learn about the complicated story of modern libraries and their evolution. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Strong communities have strong public libraries. A strong public library is more than just a fabulous building with books. It's a community anchor. It reflects and supports the values, needs, and resilience of its people. When communities invest in their libraries, they're investing in education, equity, connection, and civic health, all hallmarks of a strong society. But not all communities are making that investment. In the PBS Independent Lens documentary that airs tonight at 9 on KLRN, Free for All, the Public Library, we learn about the complicated story of the modern library's evolution and why they must be defended in these troubling times. We're joined by the two co-directors of the documentary, Dong Lungston and Lucy Faulkner, and welcome both y'all to The Source.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
So, Don, public, in the public library, the word public is doing a lot of work there. Talk about that.
Interesting that you should start on that, because I started this project in part because I was reading some news articles that surprised me a lot, coming from, I believe it was Fort Worth, Texas, about how the library there decided to take the word public out of their name and just call it the Fort Worth Library because the word public was too controversial. And that just got me thinking, like, wow, how did we get here? And we went all the way back to New England, to where most of America's earliest public libraries originated. And I was on a mission to find the first public library. And it turns out that's not an easy thing to do, because what public means to people has changed so much over the years. So there's one in Peterborough, New Hampshire, that claims to be the first one because it was the first one paid for with public funding. There's another one in Franklin, Massachusetts, that's the first one because it was the first one that was free and open to everyone. I mean, it just, the definitions of what public meant really changed a lot, and are up to, I guess, the people in their communities. But these days, you know, in a way that I don't know that has ever been before in the United States, the idea of the public commons is definitely under siege. I think one of our interviewees says it the best, Gray Brecken, who's an architectural historian, or geographical historian, sorry, says, you know, public means that it belongs to us. It's ours. That's what public means.
We paid for it with our taxes.
Right. But, and you tell in the documentary, Lucy, that it wasn't always the case that everyone could go to the public library, or at least they were segregated libraries. Maybe you had, well, here in San Antonio, we had a black public library that was now the Carver. But, you know, that wasn't until 1938 when it was named the Carver Library Branch. So there was a history, and you tell this story extraordinarily well. And I really appreciate how you do this in the documentary about how it wasn't always free for all. Lucy.
No, it was not. And in fact, originally it was just opened up to white men. And then eventually women were allowed to come in. They were, you know, left out because we had a section in the film where they were worried that they were going to, you know, tear out the fashion magazine pictures, you know. So they were not allowed in. And then also, of course, African-Americans didn't really get, you know, they had the segregated libraries. It wasn't until the early 60s that they were, that all libraries were open and the Black libraries were closed. And it wasn't until, it's not, unfortunately, you know, we could have made this film for 15 years, but we didn't include the Native American, the tribal lands did not get libraries until the 70s. So it's an evolution of being free for all, which is great. And I think is really important to remember that we are evolving as a society to embrace all the different people that embody our country.
Right. And so there's been this long history of the United States of trying to eliminate people or keep them from becoming educated, particularly communities of color, African Americans, and I'm not even making it outlawing teaching people who were enslaved or formerly enslaved to read. And so that's also a part of your story, Dawn.
That's right. And we interviewed the Librarian of Congress, who is the very first woman to be the Librarian of Congress and also the first African American and one of the first professional librarians. And what she says is that when she was getting sworn in, what really stuck out to her was the knowledge that not that long ago, it was illegal for African Americans in the Deep South to read. Slaves were banned from reading, and if they were caught reading, one of the punishments was to cut off their fingers. And this is, you know, this is gory and this is dark history, and it's hard for some of us to hear, but it's real. This is our history. And what I love about the story of the public library is moving from the ideals that left out so many people to the ideals being the wonderful ideals in our Constitution applying to everyone at the public library. And I really don't want to go backwards. And right now there's a lot of pressure to take out a lot of books about African American history, a lot of books that are incredibly important to especially teens who are questioning their sexuality. And the list kind of goes on and on.
Right. So that was Carla Hayden, who was the
first
woman African-American to serve in the Library of Congress. And so I just wanted to, you talk about the removal of books from libraries. I want to jump on this right away because this kind of makes my blood boil, about the books that they're removing from the U.S. Naval War College. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, How to Be an Anti-Racist, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man, Why Didn't We Riot, A Black Man in Trumpland. These are some of the books that they are removing from the War College library, Naval War College. And it goes on and on like this. The Gangs of Zion, A Black Cop's Crusade in a Mormon Country, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. These are the books that they're removing from that library. I don't know what connects all these books, but neighbors, help me out here. Why would they do that?
Are you talking to us?
Yeah, anyone, help me out. It's like, seems, but Mein Kampf is still there on the shelves.
Yep. Well, you know what? Let's talk about Mein Kampf, because that was a book that was debated a lot in public libraries when we were at war with Germany. And what librarians, for the most part, decided was, unlike Nazi Germany, where they were burning books, in the United States, they were going to keep that book on the shelves because people needed to know what those ideas were, so that they knew what they were fighting against. So I'm not advocating for Mein Kampf being removed from the library. There's plenty of people who might disagree with me on that one. But what I'm arguing for is letting people decide what they want to read, not other people in the community deciding for them.
Right. Okay. Oh, I got to take a break here. We're going to continue this conversation. Our phone lines are open. We definitely want to hear from our listeners about what was your spark moment when you were a child going to the library. What was that like when you walked in and you learned about this availability of knowledge and access? And 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What is your favorite local branch library? We'd love to hear your stories. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the critical role that public libraries play in our civil society. Tonight there is a PBS Independent Lens documentary that airs on KLRN at 9 o'clock, Free for All, the Public Library. And we have with us the two co-directors of that documentary, Don Lugston and Lucy Faulkner. And we invite you to call in to tell us your favorite library stories, what's your favorite library branch, what was your spark moment when you went to the library for the first time, 833-877-8255. So the San Antonio Public Library goes back to 1903. It was established with funding from philanthropist Andrew Carnegie. And you talk about the Carnegie endowment, how he provided libraries across the country, working with local communities to do that. You give a view of him, warts and all. I do want to mention that, you know, the local library that was first built here, and the land was donated by the Campman family. You had to donate. You had to have your own land, and you also had to come up with a tax base in order to sustain the library. So talk about that story, Lucy.
Yeah. So Carnegie, he was a steel magnate, and he made a bunch of money by exploiting his workers. He had the bloodiest union battle in the history of the union in Braddock, Pennsylvania, and Homestead, Pennsylvania. He thought differently, but he made the money and he said he was going to give it all away. And so he invited people to write to him for grants to build libraries. And so most of them were sent in by women's clubs who said that they wanted a library in their town. And so he would give the money for building the building. He actually had set groups of architectural drawings that they could choose from if they didn't have their own architectural drawing. So a lot of libraries you'll notice when you walk in the front door, off to the right is the children's room. First is the circulation desk, and then to the right is the children's room, and to the left is the adults' room. But the guarantee he wanted, if he was going to give this money away, was that the town had to agree to tax themselves, and they had to tax themselves enough to 10%. They had to give the land. They had to tax themselves so they could give get more books in or anything that they had, you know, circulation, and they had to pay the librarians and for the upkeep and utilities.
So here in San Antonio, we had the Carnegie Libraries at 210 West Market Street, but then not long afterwards, it was destroyed by this great flood that we had in San Antonio, and then we the city rebuilt it, but now it's in more of an Art Deco kind of design, and it was there as the main library for many years, but then it became the Hertzberg Circus Library for a long time, and now it is being used as the Briscoe Western Art Museum. So it's kind of still in use, although it's gone through some, you know, ups and downs. So why, Don, did Carnegie, why did he do this, and how influential was this in the creation of library mania across America?
It was incredibly important. But before we talk about Carnegie, I want to back up just a little bit, because San Antonio is one of the towns that I did a lot of research in, and it's got a really interesting history that's very similar to libraries all around the country that gets left out of this story, which is that before Andrew Carnegie gave the money to build the San Antonio Library, there were a group of women. In the case of San Antonio, it was women from St. Mary's Catholic Church who wanted a library. There was already a library in San Antonio for gentlemen only.
Right.
And these educated young ladies were like, no, we want a library too. And they opened the Alamo Free Library, which I guess was an inferior building. And so when Carnegie came along, they also led the effort to get the city to donate the land and to petition Carnegie to build a library in their town. So women played this incredibly important role in bringing libraries across the United States, hand in hand with Andrew Carnegie. But without them, I don't know that half of the libraries, at least, that got built would have happened. So what Andrew Carnegie and those libraries and those women's clubs managed to do is turn an idea into reality. You know, in most countries at that time, there, of course, were already libraries. Many of them were public, but they often were just in like the capital city in downtown and were really a place that only the elite were welcomed, or at least the very well-educated already. And what we did in the United States, way before most other countries, is bring the library to the people. So whether that meant libraries opening up in small towns, thanks to grants from Andrew Carnegie or from other philanthropists that were more local. And it also meant the little branch library. So bringing libraries into the neighborhoods in big cities that weren't just downtown so that they were serving the people in the community that they could walk to and where they felt welcome. So like James Baldwin talks about how he did not feel welcome going down to Midtown Manhattan and going to the beautiful library on Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street, but that he went almost every day to the 135th Street Library in Harlem and he read all the books there and it completely shaped who he was. And there's just story after like that, especially new Americans, immigrants. My grandma was an immigrant and she had never set foot in a library before, but her library in her immigrant neighborhood on the south side of Chicago was where my dad went almost every day after school, because his mom was a working single mother. And that is a really classic American story.
Let's go back to what you were talking about, how women have played such an important role in the development of the library system. And so we have Melville Dewey. People know him as the Dewey Decimal guy, and he's got a complicated history. But as I understand it, that not credited, but there were many women that actually helped Dewey develop the Dewey Decimal system, and their names are not remembered.
Very few of these women are remembered from the early days of librarianship, which is one of the reasons why we decided to try and focus on some of them. Melville Dewey is such a fascinating guy. I could go on forever about him, but let's just say that he played a huge role in opening the entire profession up to women for really the first time, I think. He founded the Library School, he founded the American Library Association, the American Library Journal, and he fought to have women become a key part of the librarianship profession in the United States, but for mixed reasons. And one of the reasons is that he thought that they would be cheaper to hire, that they wouldn't demand as much in terms of salaries. Another one was that he thought that their female brain was better suited for tedious tasks. And then it also emerged several decades later that he would, how do I put this?
He was a predator.
Yeah, he was an early Me Too guy. and that he, you know, took advantage, especially of the women who were not of his social class, who worked under him repeatedly.
And he was an anti-Semite.
Oh, he was an anti-Semite. He was a racist. He was in many ways a man who embodied all of the prejudices of his time. So he's a really mixed bag, and we owe him a lot. And we also need to not whitewash his history.
Right. But yes, look at him warts and all and in context and see him for what he was. But the fact that you know, the exploitation or the gender suppression, oppression of women, so that they would be put in these roles and work for cheap. You know, America was built on that.
Yep.
You know,
sure was.
And teachers, nurses, and in libraries.
And you know, the gender gap is still not closed. Let's be real here.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's like lots of examples of that here in San Antonio. I mentioned the Carver Library, which was the black library segregation, you know, that was, you know, fostered under the leadership of Prudence Curry. And she's, you know, remembered for her leadership at that library and making it work for so many years in a crucial time in San Antonio's history. The thing about women could not be married, is that, was that a rule? How did that work?
Well, you know, libraries are local, so each library sets their own rules. We think of it as an American institution, an American tradition, but there's no such thing as the national public library. Each community decides their own rules in libraries, and an awful lot of them back in the day, women couldn't be married in order to work in the library. And that was true for teachers too, and nurses.
And so what was the, so you attracted a certain type of woman for, you know, that type of thing?
Well,
you know, and there's a stereotype.
Yeah, there definitely is. And there are also rumors that Dewey only let attractive women into his library program, or women he found attractive, that you had to submit a photo along with your application. I haven't found actual historical proof of that, but it's certainly rumored quite a bit. But what is definitely true is that almost all the women who were admitted to his library program and other early library programs were white, unmarried, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. You couldn't be Catholic and get into a lot of library schools. And certainly you also, there were very few women who, from the like working class who were admitted, or immigrant women. They tended to be middle class or upper middle class.
And then when you would learn about the history of some of these women who have dedicated their lives to, you know, a local library, they had a longtime female companion that they cohabitated with, and that was the way.
Absolutely. You know, there's a huge hidden history of gay and lesbian and other queer people making a lot of change in all professions.
They're caretakers, they're helpers. Yeah. You know, they're givers.
What was interesting to me is several of the librarians that we profiled who lived with women their whole lives also were able to adopt children back then. I think because there were so many orphans and things got a lot stricter as the years went on, but quite a few of them formed families with children that they adopted. And for others, all the children at the library were their children.
I also think that maybe, you know, women were not paid as well as men, so they had to cohabitate together in order to pay the rent or buy a house or something. So we have to think of that as well.
Yeah, we can't rewrite history without knowing all the facts.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's, you know, try to, you know, spend a minute to think about that. So, but why are the women so hard? Why are they not recognized, do you think, Lucy?
Well, I think it's because librarians, they're really good at helping each other, but they're not really good at tooting their own horns. You know, they love helping other people. Like you said, they're helpers, and they just didn't think about chronicling their lives and their histories. And we found a lot of, not a lot, but we found enough to, because we didn't go everywhere, but we found enough of these little photo albums. We found one underneath the sink in a staff room of these old, like I think it was from the 30s, photos from the from a library. I don't want to mention the library, but like we found tons of videotapes in the San Francisco Public Library in this closet that had not been cataloged at all, and we went and cataloged them for them because we found these amazing PSAs from Robin Williams about the opening of a new branch library that was just hilarious. But all kinds of, they had a little studio in there in the downstairs that in during the 70s, they started filming, visiting authors and celebrities and things. And these, they just were just all piled into this one little closet. So yeah, libraries are not really good. They're great at keeping the history of their towns and stuff, but not themselves.
All right, we're taking a break here. We're going to continue talking about our local public library system. PBS documentary airs tonight at 9 o'clock. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Tonight on KLRN PBS, the Independent Lens documentary airs at 9 o'clock, Free for All, the Public Library, where we learned about the complicated story of the modern library's evolution and some of its challenges today. We're speaking with two co-directors of the documentary, Don Lugstom and Lucy Faulkner. But before we get back to them, Barry Brake, who you may know from KPAC, our classical music sister station, was excited about the topic, and he had a library story that he wanted to share. So, Barry,
yes.
Tell us.
Hi. Well, you know, we went to the Landa Library when I was a kid, and we befriended the librarian, Carl Bernal, and we thought of him as our family librarian and friend. And I saw him just out of the blue about 2 weeks before I was going to get married. He was like, Barry, and I'm like, Carl. And so we caught up, and I said, I'm getting married in a couple of weeks. Come to the wedding. So he comes, he brings a standard gift, but he also gives me an envelope full of Thai currency. He had heard we're going to Thailand for our honeymoon and immediately started recommending books, by the way. He got all excited about it. And so, but he gave us currency, which is great because we got there super late. And so we didn't have to worry about currency. We had enough for a cab ride and the first hotel night, but we had a little bit of money left over. And I just kept looking during our honeymoon for a way to spend it. And at one cafe, we saw Jamaican Blue Mountain Coffee. I had only heard of it. I had never tasted it, but I heard of it through the Danny Dunn books, which he recommended to me all those years ago. And so I ordered a Jamaican Blue Mountain Coffee. It was exactly the amount that Carl had. It was just like all worked out perfectly. And so I just sat there in that cafe and I just drank a toast to Carl and to the library and to the people who expand our horizons and introduce me to a faraway land through books.
Landa Library, beautiful library.
Mm.
You know, what a treasure that is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Fond memories there.
All right, Barry, thank you for sharing that story with us. We appreciate that. All right. So Don and Lucy, that's one story of how, you know, a library impacts people.
There's so many of those stories out there. Pretty much everywhere we went, somebody had a library story that they wanted to share with us. One of the ones I remember from San Antonio was I read somewhere in the paper that there was a library in San Antonio that had no books, that it was all electronic. And I was fascinated by that idea of like, could that be the library of the future? And I went, of course, San Antonio has a marvelous public library system. We visited there too. But we went to this one little library. It was called the Bibliotheque. And I'm not sure if it still exists.
But there's multiple now.
Oh, interesting. The one we went to was in a predominantly poor Hispanic neighborhood, and it was run by a young man who told me that his parents were Mexican-American civil rights activists who fought for access to the schools and for voting rights, and that what he saw as his mission in life was to provide internet access to his community. And that's why he had that job at that library. And he just had story after story about helping people fill out job applications, helping people learn English there, kids with their homework. I could have made a whole film about that spot.
Musical instruments too, right? Were they?
Right. Yeah. They checked out musical instruments there. And what he told me is like, of course we have books. We just don't have paper books. They're all on the cloud.
Let's go another. Go ahead.
Sorry. We did actually a whole big long storytelling series at the San Francisco Public Library. For 3 days, we set up a camera and we asked people to come in and just tell their library story. And the first three people who sat in front of that camera cried. The mm-hmm. library meant so much to them. But the one that really stood out to me was this older woman who, I forget where she was, somewhere in the South, she grew up, and she was at the dinner table and she kind of suspected that her dad killed somebody. He was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and so she didn't know what the Ku Klux Klan was. So she went to her library to read up on what the Ku Klux Klan was all about, and at the next and then she the next dinner she went to at the dinner table, she confronted her dad and, said, "What's going on here? Why are you doing this?" And that was just powerful.
Let's go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'd love to hear your stories of how the library impacted you. Let's go to Paul. And Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. Great show. I
Thank you.
heard one of your guests mention that they were from the South Side of Chicago, and I grew up there. And I remember going to the library on Stony Island at 88th, Avalon Branch, and spent a lot of time there. I remember that I could only spend so much time there on the afternoons on Saturday because it was right next door to a liquor store, Kenwood Liquors. So the crowd would overflow a little bit early before closing time, but still spent a lot of afternoons in that place. And in later years, I heard they shut it down and built a much nicer one further up Stony, like in the 70s, I think, or maybe in the eight around 80s. But at any rate, when I retired to come down here, I made sure that my kids went to a really great library here, which is at Brook Hollow, and let them spend a lot of time there and browse the books. They had a lot of programs at Brook Hollow, and that's still where I go to vote. So I thought I'd share that since there was a fellow Southsider from Chicago on the That was
Well, I'm
one of
glad
your
you called
guests.
in, Paul. Thank you so much for those memories. Thank you for sharing that. So I do want to mention about how San Antonio did eventually desegregate, integrate its public library system. Of course, we had the colored branch of the San Antonio Public Library that was created in 1930. It was later renamed the Carver Branch in 1938. But in 1943, they began to have hours set aside for African Americans, Black patrons to come in specifically to the main library that they had, which is now the was. And then full integration of the San Antonio Public Libraries was quietly implemented in 1949, making the city one of the first in the South to desegregate its libraries. And it was done without any public announcement. They just sort of just did it and allowed community networks to inform our Black residents that they were now welcome there. How common is a story like that, Dawn?
Quite common throughout the South. And in the North, you get a variation on it, which is that people of color weren't officially banned from the libraries the way they were in the South, but they were made to feel very unwelcome and encouraged to go to just the one branch that was located in the predominantly African American neighborhood that was sort of known unofficially as the Negro or the colored branch, using the language that they used back then. I wanted to say another thing that San Antonio was on the forefront of was doing away with library fines recently. I think it was maybe happened 5 years ago or so there. And that is a story that we were told by our library director at the time in San Francisco, who grew up in San Antonio. He was the child of immigrants from Mexico. And he and his brother went to the library as children once. And I can't remember if they lost the book or if they just forgot to return it. He said he lived in terror for like 10 years that the library police were going to be coming to his door to take them away because they hadn't paid their fines at the library, and that kept him from going to the library until he got to high school. And so this idea of making it less foreboding and making people more welcome, just the fact of charging fines often discourages certain people from going to the library. And we had a older lady in Chinatown who told us that she was not allowed to use the library because her parents were worried she was going to run up fines that they couldn't afford to pay. So kudos to San Antonio for making their libraries fine-free now.
Another caller. Let's go to Rhoda. And Rhoda, you're on the air.
Hi. My story is about Long Island, which is where I grew up. And I was in seventh or eighth grade. And I spent most on the way home from school. Especially if it rained, my mother would let me stay at the library until the rain stopped. She was afraid I was going to melt, I guess. At any rate, I picked up about four books, went to the librarian, and she looked at them and took one of them and said, "You can't take this one home." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because you don't have an adult card." I said, "Oh, but it's pretty easy to read." She said, "No, you can't take it." And the thing that pleased me about the book was that my name is Rhoda. The book was about a little girl named Rhoda who was a bad seed, and that was the name of the book. And so she said, "Well, if you want, you can go home and get a note from your mother and then come back and get the book." I said, "No, that's okay. I'll just take the other three." And I'll put this back in the stacks for you. She said, "Oh, thank you." So I went back to the stacks, sat down at a table and read the book and went home.
And so were you corrupted by that book, Rhoda?
No, I have not murdered anybody in my life.
And do you, are you, how do you, how's that, when you tell the story, are you proud of it? Are you, is it a warning? What is a cautionary tale? What's your story? What's the bottom line?
It's delight that I could go someplace and read all the books that I wanted and not have to worry about it. So after the first time, I got old enough so that I could take any book out. And I don't know what they do with little kids now if they say, "No, you're not old enough for that."
Yeah. Well, Rhoda, thank you so much for your call. We're up against a break, so we're going to take this break, and we'll come back. We'll continue talking about the documentary that airs tonight on KLRN, Free for All, the Public Library. We do want to hear your library stories. 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about libraries, a public, local public library, their importance in creating strong communities. We're hearing about the documentary that airs tonight on KLRN, tonight at 9 o'clock, Free for All, the Public Library. Got an email from a listener. "What sparked my longtime love of reading was that when I was 12 and checked out the book To Kill a Mockingbird, after that, I would leave the library with an armful of books." Don Logstam and Lucy Faulkner are the co-directors of the documentary. And so, Lucy, To Kill a Mockingbird is one of those books that seems to get banned a lot, even today.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But when they ban books, it seems to, you know, people will want to read it more because, oh, what are they trying to keep from us? it's all kinds of things are being banned. It's, you know, Malala, my name is Malala, is banned. They were trying to ban Mark Twain because it had, you know, the N-word in it. And everybody's trying to ban everything, but as one of the characters in our film says, you know, we're not here to, you know, tell people what they can and can't read. You know, it's up to you to read, you know, or if you're a parent, it's, you know, you have to parent your children to decide what they want to read. You can, they're not there to judge. They just can just give you whatever you want.
Don Lugston, the Trump administration is defunding under their DOGE, with Elon Musk, the federal agency that does pass on federal funds to local public libraries. How big of a deal is this?
It's a really big deal. And it's a really big deal for small libraries in small towns and rural libraries. You know, the San Antonio Library is not going to go anywhere. The city funds it generously, and I'm sure you guys have lots of philanthropy that keeps it running too.
The San Antonio Public Library Foundation.
There you go. But in smaller communities, a lot of these libraries operate on shoestrings, and they're very dependent on IMLS funding. Tribal libraries on native land are almost completely dependent on that funding. So it's a scary situation right now. And I know that the American Library Institute, American Library Association is fighting back by suing the government to try and repeal that. I want to also point out that IMLS is not the only agency that's under threat that has to do with freedom of information. The NEH has been slashed. Our project was made possible by funding from the NEH. We wouldn't have been able to make this without it. It's one of the primary funders of historical documentaries about this country. And PBS is also, their future is under threat too, and that's where we're broadcasting, and that's where you can find documentaries like ours that aren't about either crime or celebrities, but are about important chapters of American history.
In your documentary, Dawn, you point out, you make this link, how the public libraries were integrated, they were important to local communities, they were helping so many immigrants and people of color and Spanish speakers, bringing Spanish language books into libraries. That was at one time controversial, and now we can't even imagine not doing that. And then suddenly we had this taxpayer revolt, which we're seeing now today with DOGE cutting funding to anything with the word public attached to it, public transportation, public education, public broadcasting, public libraries. So
it seems like
public parks. Yeah. So you are you seem to be making a link there that the pushback trying to fund things that actually help the people is doesn't sit too well with the people who, they're worried about their property taxes. So can you talk about that?
Sure, I'm happy to. This tax revolt is nothing new. It's been going on for a long time. It started in large part in California with Proposition 13 back in the 70s when I was just entering college, or actually I was still in high school, and I mentioned that in the film. And it's gone on, under both parties, actually. Different emphasis, different amounts of cuts, different ways they get cut, but it's lasted a long time, and I think we're seeing a half a century of results, which is that a lot of our public infrastructure is crumbling. A lot of public libraries are closing. Our public education is in crisis. One of the scholars in our film says, and this I think is a direct quote, what the line he says is that public has become a bad word. And that's a huge change. And Americans forget what they once had as part of our public commons that we all took for granted was good public schools. But we didn't all take them for granted because not everybody was able to use them. But how many of us don't have parents and grandparents and great grandparents who were educated through the public school system, who had access to books because of public libraries? And, at least from my point of view, I want to be able to pass that down to my grandchildren and their children, and I want to see that continue as something that I'm proud of as an American.
Librarians are on the front line in so many ways. They have to deal with some of the chaos that happens in public libraries because of our shrinking social safety net. People have to go to libraries sometimes just to find a place so they can go to the bathroom, if they're unhoused, and they're also dealing with the Proud Boys storming in because they don't like drag queen story hour, and they're also being sued in a possibility of in case they somebody gets a book that they don't like. So how is it that librarians are really the toughest ones of the bunch, who really have to have this a code of ethics? They will not share the who checks out what books. And of course, during the Red Scare we had here in Bexar County, our sheriff's department was demanding the list of who was checking out communist books, and they wouldn't give it up. So there was, why is it that librarians are made of that special stuff, Dawn?
That's a really good question. Not sure I know the answer to that. I think they're dedicated public servants in the same way that our public teachers are and our social workers. I'm not sure that there's something special about them compared to other public servants, but they're there to provide information. That's their mission. They really see it as a mission. And they're there to provide the information that you want. And that's actually a fairly new thing in American librarianship. You know, we think of librarians as having always been on the forefront of anti-censorship and protecting patrons' privacy, but that was not always the case. One thing I learned is that in World War I, libraries got rid of all their books in German in most communities. They were fine with censoring German books. And then in World War II, the librarians took a different stand. And that was sort of the beginning of really pushing back against the idea of censorship. They're like, no, we want to keep these books here for people to know what's going on and to make their own decisions. And I think that that's one of the great things about the profession right now is they've been on the forefront for close to a century of protecting our rights as Americans.
What's the trend look like for libraries? We know we are seeing a reduction in the number of libraries across the state, across the country, particularly in rural areas. We're seeing, you know, the federal funding that's going to cause even more contraction in the availability of services. You know, what do you think is going to be happening, Dawn?
I'm not a fortune teller, and the one thing that I do know is that it's up to us. You know, these are local institutions that we decide whether or not we want in our communities, and we decide whether or not they're worth paying for. And poll after poll across the political spectrum, something like 90% of Americans regularly say that they still think that libraries are an essential service in their community, that it makes their neighborhood a better place. And if we all believe that, then we need to speak up and we need to vote for them. When there's issues that come up on the ballot, we need to call our representatives if their futures are in danger. And we need to go in and thank our librarians for what they do. Because like you said, it's not easy to go from being a respected professional in your community to somebody who's under attack.
And like I said, librarians are not great at tooting their own horn. So, you know, everybody's got to do it for them because I think I read, I forget what somebody said, you know, maybe it costs $1.06 on your property taxes that's going to your public library. But if you take out one book or one ebook or one movie, that's paid for, you know, it's less than a cup of coffee. Like, why wouldn't you support that? Even if you don't use it, but you know, you're the little kid down the street, you know, might want to check out, you know, Dora the Explorer.
Right. And educating the community, it's job development, as a resource that impacts, and it just seems to pay so many dividends. It also houses the community's history and memories. To lose a local public library is to lose too much. But yet you document that happening, Dawn. And what was that like?
It's scary to me, and I really can't imagine a United States without public libraries. When we started this project, what we were hearing a lot of was, from all kinds of people, was, libraries are going to be history soon. We don't need them anymore because all they are is places to store old books. And now we have the internet and we can get all the information and all the literature that we need off the internet. And it's true. We have this massive new
wave. Yeah, but they censor the internet. They took off the Jackie Robinson's page, and things like that. We need books. We need the physical objects.
We need books, and libraries aren't just about paper books either. You can get ebooks at the library. You can go to your librarian and help learn which source you trust for your high school paper, because you can't trust everything that's on the internet. And you can.
All right, so I got to thank you guys. Thank you so much. It's Free for All, the Public Library, airs tonight on KLRN. 9 o'clock. Thank you so much, Dawn Lugstom and Lucy Faulkner. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio.
Thanks.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.